state that we're doing a repeat recording today of Deanna Spingola, who's come back again to do another interview with Dr. Carlstrom and myself, and she's been gracious enough to do this, and so has Eric. And I, just to give a little bit of an info on Deanna again, for those who haven't heard our other interview with her, she has been a quilt designer and is the author of two books. She has traveled extensively teaching and lecturing on her unique methods. She has always been an avid reader of nonfiction works designed to educate rather than entertain. She is active in family history research and lectures on that topic. Currently, she is the director of the local Family History Center. She has a great interest in politics and the direction of current government policies, particularly as they relate to the Constitution. So, Deanna, would you like to go ahead and add anything to that, or did you want to go ahead and just kind of fill in where we...
Let's just jump into the subject. We were going to discuss the situation in Colorado and the government's land grab, the Army's land grab, in southeastern Colorado, which they initially took some land through eminent domain back in 1983. And there were people who did not want to sell, who resisted selling, and they ended up, there were 11 ranchers, and they ended up going through court and actually having their land taken. And the Army at that time said, you know, this is all we need. We won't need any more. And now they're back again trying to take, at this point in time, about 418,000 acres. But their goal, their total goal, is 7 million acres, which would be the entire southeast corner of Colorado.
I was actually out there just recently, and it does look like it's the whole southeast corner of the state. I mean, there were signs all over the place. People they were put on semi.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you, Deanna. Can I ask you? You mentioned the goal is to acquire 17 million acres. Is this in
seven.
Some document? Oh, seven. Okay.
Seven
is this in some document that you've read, or where do you get that?
Yes. Yes, it is. It is in the government's own documents. And specifically in a document, let me give you the title here, it is in a document entitled Army Ranges and Training Land Program, Analysis of Alternative Study, Pinyon Canyon, Maneuver Site, Colorado. And it's the 7th Infantry Division in Fort Carson, Colorado. And the date of the document is May 6th of 04.
Do you have any understanding as to why you think they want that much land? That's quite a bit of land.
The Pentagon now occupies just in the United States about 31,700,692 acres. That's just in the United States and its territories. And another 32,408,262 acres in foreign countries, for a total of 64,108,954 acres. And yet they claim to be strapped for a training area. And they also are in at least 63 countries. Our military bases are in 63 countries. And we have personnel, military personnel, in 156 countries. And yet we are supposedly the greatest military, the strongest, greatest military force in the world. So who in heaven's name would even dream of attacking us? We also are, according to the Constitution, we are not supposed to have a standing army, which means an army that is always ready to fight. Now, the Congress can call up an army and fund it for 2 years, and then that funding must be renewed after 2 years. And that has not happened for some time, particularly since the Department of Defense was created in 1947 after the Second World War. And so with the Department of Defense, they are kind of autonomous from Congress. They pretty well just kind of do what they want to do. And
Going back to Melody's question, 7 million acres out of apparently you saying that the government, the military controls about 63 or 64 million acres total. 7 million acres in southeastern Colorado would be over a tenth of the entire holding. So why the extraordinary size do you think the military would want that size of parcel in southeastern Colorado? Do you have any ideas about that?
Well, they say they need it. They say they need it in order to conduct the military training that is essential to fight in the Middle East. And they say that the terrain in that area is perfect and matches the terrain in the Middle East. Of course, I think probably there are other areas that also would fall into that category. So I think it's a direct attack against the ranchers and their use of their own private land, and it's to depress, I believe, the food industry even more than it has already been depressed. There have been so many ranchers who have been put out of business throughout the entire country, about 500,000 just in the last 20 years. So that we are not only producing cars and other products, we are not even producing our own food. So we're becoming very dependent on imports, which is not a very good situation to be in.
We get over 2/3 of our oil from foreign sources, and increasingly more of our food. Yes.
Right. And people should be independent and be able to take care of themselves, and that should apply to countries also. And obviously, we are being actually transformed into a third world country deliberately. And for the army, see, the army is using the patriotism card. They're saying, oh, we've got to take care of our troops, we've got to support our troops, and provide them with adequate training, and so we need this land. Well, you know, a lot of people aren't going to fight that because they don't recognize that is just a fallacious claim.
Deanna, have you heard anything about Colorado Springs or Denver being like the
hub for the new? Yes.
Okay.
Say that again, please. Colorado Springs or Denver being the new what?
Kind of like the Western capital. Is that what you would call it?
Well, it would be the capital of that area. But what you're talking about maybe is the NAFTA situation with the highways and things going up through there. That it's part of the that network.
Well, actually, I've even heard that they may have moved or in the process of moving Langley to that area. Have you heard that at all?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
Would this have to do with the proposed North American Union, perhaps?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
They're saying, oh, that's not going to happen now. But I don't believe that at all. I think that too many people were finding out about it. And it was getting publicized on CNN, and so I think that they're just trying to back off and say, oh, we've scrapped that idea. But I don't believe that at all.
Well, in a sense, it almost looks like they're circumventing that and kind of jumping over going the North American Union and just going for the whole ball of bowl of wax in this. Because, I mean, from what I'm hearing some of the leadership speak, it sounds as though, you know, they're just saying we're in the New World Order and...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And de facto, I mean, we already have open borders. the government just simply has not declared that, okay, we are one country now. We're the North American Union. And of course, the Amero, the supposed new money that is supposed to be used in the North American Union, is certainly, I think, in the horizon. Now, Canada is resisting this. There are some people up there in Canada who are definitely resisting this. But more often than not, in this country, people really aren't even aware of it. You know, just the various two people. I certainly don't talk about this on the mass media, and they certainly don't talk about the southeastern Colorado issue in the mass media. Just the people there know about it, basically. I mean, the local newspapers certainly talk about it. In fact, there was an article in, let's see, which newspaper was it? Just recently, in the Pueblo Chieftain, which has done a very good job of publicizing the situation. And they had a news article on October 30th of this year about the situation with the map. Now, this big map was printed in the 04 Fort Carson report, which is the one that I referenced before, and with a plan to purchase up to 7 million acres. And the Army said, oh, heck no. We're just always planning things. That doesn't mean they're going to go through. And the opposition group, not one more acre, which has been fantastic in fighting this situation. They've gone to court, and they've been very progressive in fighting this. And they obtained a copy of this map 2 years ago, and they confronted the Army officials about it. And you know, they've been stonewalled in from every corner, but they actually have the map, and they've gone to court, and the court has seen it. And so, you know, what are they going to say now? But basically, the Army is after 7 million acres, and they said in July, I believe it was, that they would settle for 80,000. And then they bumped it up to 100,000 because they had somebody that was somewhat willing to sell, a fellow by the name of Craig Walker, who is a Denver businessman. And he's really not even your traditional rancher. He just acquired a 40,000-acre ranch. Then he acquired a 60,000-acre ranch. And he said, oh, gosh, I would never sell them to the Army. And I haven't even talked to the Army. Nobody's even talked to me from the Army. But he has been in cahoots with the Nature Conservancy, which is a very... They're a bad group. I mean, they're really backed by some of the foundations.
I'm really bumping into them in my area, and I did an interview just a week or two ago about with one of our commissioners here who has been who helped create the Wilderness Society, according to him. I do know that he's been heavily involved in it, and up until recently I couldn't find anything more than he'd been a field representative for them, but now he's got quite a bit of information up on the net now. Within the last few days I've found, it may have been there, but this is the first time I've been able to run across it, so stating that he's been heavily involved with this Nature Conservancy and the Wilderness Society, and it kind of I would venture to say they're very much tied together in this wilding of America. Do you think so?
Oh, absolutely. They are absolutely, because they're backed by the same foundations and in cahoots with the Army. I mean, the Nature Conservancy has seized a lot of, or has purchased a lot of land that they promised the seller, oh, this is going to remain as private property. I think they've got close to 10 million acres that they have actually turned over to the government after promising that it would stay as private property. And they will do anything they can to conjure people into giving up their land by lying to them. and by, you know, saying, all, you know, oh, we want to conserve this land for future generations, which is just nothing but new world doublespeak is what it is. I mean, that's, and you have the several outfits are involved in this, and they actually put together five non-government organizations, the Conservation Fund, the Colorado Open Lands, the Nature Conservancy Trust for Public Lands, and the Colorado Conservation Trust. And what this group intends to do is they want to protect several thousand acres of land, and it so happens to be in the very same area that the army wants to seize the land from. So what they're trying to do then is say, oh well, you know, if they can control the land by saying, oh, we're going to protect this land for against whatever, then they can control and regulate it. So you might as well, you know, it's the same thing. Whatever they control, whatever they regulate and control, they could come out and say, well, gosh, you can't graze your cattle here, and you can't do this here, and you can't do that here. So basically, it isn't just the Army that's going after these ranchers. It's the conservation, the fake conservation groups. And they are fake because of who they are backed by.
And so you say in corporations, or are they non-governmental organizations or tax exempt?
Right.
Okay.
Right, they're tax exempt.
Well, I can give a little update here, and Melody as well, and whether or not you've heard this, I don't know, but the brand new Baca National Wildlife Refuge, which was just created a couple years ago and has not even had a management plan yet written, has expedited, as per the executive order of Bush and Cheney, the development of gas and oil on federal land. And what they there's been a process involved. They tried to circumvent the NEPA process, the National Environmental Policy Act. Now we know from a FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, filed recently that the Fish and Wildlife representatives were actually working with the gas company's lawyers. The gas company is Lexham Incorporated from Canada, to write up a document that would be an end run around the NEPA process, and that would, of course, say there would be no impacts, and they would mitigate everything, blah, blah, blah. So in spite of the fact that these FOIAs have come out, and despite the fact that we've seen how much corruption there is and cronyism between the oil and gas industry and the government, say in the Denver area recently, the draft environmental assessment that they put out last May, which all of us who looked at it said it was a whitewash and a complete joke, the Fish and Wildlife Service has now accepted that and says this will now go forward to be the final environmental assessment, and they won't need to do an environmental impact statement. So therefore, let's just go ahead and start the drilling. So as far as the Fish and Wildlife Service is concerned, right now, Lexham can begin drilling on the ground anytime. Now, there are a couple lawsuits that may be filed by a local environmental group around Durango and Crestone, but what we see there is again, an attempt to just kind of circumvent all the protocol, the required rules, and expedite gas and oil drilling. So,
right.
I just thought I'd update that, because that's a new development.
Oh, goodness. And there's no oversight with any of these bureaucracies. There's none at all. They all fall under the cabinet, the president's cabinet, which
yes.
has no oversight from Congress. And so, basically, they just go in and do whatever they want. And
yeah.
they're taking public lands and allowing big corporations to come in and basically seize the public assets and earn the money and earn all the profits from it. And yeah, go ahead.
Well, have you run across them, the government letting a lot of resource companies come in and mine for those resources when they do this kind of land acquisition?
Well, you know, the United States has been doing that all over the world. In John Perkins' book, The Confessions of an Economic Hitman, they've been doing this all over. And, like, they'll go into a country, say Venezuela, and they will offer to give them a loan so that the country can develop some infrastructure. And that infrastructure will only be beneficial to a small number of people. And then when the loan, and usually it's from the BIS or some other big bank.
Yeah, IMF.
Yeah, when the loan cannot be paid back, then they say, well, okay, we're just going to have to take some of your assets, some of your resources. And so the corporations go in and basically steal the assets. And it's trickery. It's egregious. And we've done it all over the world. And then if that doesn't work, what John Perkins says is that they send in the jackals, and the jackals go in and they assassinate leaders.
Right.
And, who don't play along, right, yeah.
And that is what happened with Saddam Hussein, who was a terrible man. I mean, he was a CIA asset and certainly assassinated his share of people when the CIA hired him. And so he was smart enough. He just kept out of their range, out of target range. And so that's why you had a war in 1991 over there. And that's why you had sanctions. And then finally they did end up capturing him or his double.
After going to war again in 2003, yes.
Exactly. So,
yeah.
And of course they sell these wars by saying, oh my goodness, this guy is so bad. This is really terrible. And, you know, constitutionally, we have no obligation to interfere. We have no business interfering in another country's politics or whom they want to choose as their leaders. And his big, claimed he wanted to, drill for gas, for oil, for the benefit of his own country. Apparently he changed, loyalties and thought, well, why should I let, Rockefeller come in and take all of our oil? And so when we went in March of 2003, it wasn't to actually create a democracy or take out a guy. It was to shut down the production of oil, because basically, he was only drilling. They were only drilling maybe 15% of all of the oil availabilities in that country. And so, what we do is go. What the oil companies did was, or what the government did for the oil companies, go in and take over the country and protect the oil ministry, which is the only building that the military actually protected, and then to protect the pipelines that are being laid, and then build the embassy and 14 military bases. Now, you know, that spells longevity, and it doesn't matter which president comes in or who is elected, we're there to stay for a long time. And, given the military bases that we're building.
It doesn't sound like we've picked up much different tactics than the English did when they were doing their empire building.
Right. We are an imperialist nation.
Well, you've made the point in our previous discussions, Deanna, that basically American foreign policy is dictated by the oil companies. Would you care to expand on that a little bit?
Yes, it's dictated by the oil companies, but it's also dictated by a lot of the other companies. Okay, so for instance, in Iraq, we went in there, and in 1991, we destroyed all but about 4% of their electrical capability. We took out bridges. We bombed their water supply. We just absolutely devastated their entire infrastructure. Okay, then then we come in later after we've destroyed, and Bechtel and Halliburton and some of these other great big huge construction companies come in and say, oh, well, you know, we got to build these, build up the infrastructure again and make money. It's war is an industrial effort. It's like, okay, you make cars, you know, Ford makes cars and shoemakers make shoes and you know, banks make war, because that's who benefits is the banks, who lend the money usually to both sides, and the corporations that the board of directors for a lot of those banks are the same board of directors that sit on major corporations. And we also have, the government also has favorite corporations that they give out no-bid contracts to.
Do you find that a lot of those are engineering firms?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
I mean, even like in Colorado there, with Fort Carson, they decided that they were going to replace all of the housing for the military. And so they brought in a company. It was a German company. In fact, the same company that used slave labor and during the World War II came in, got the contract, and replaced all of these all of the housing. And they also will be the people who will collect the rent and maintain the parks and all the other infrastructure that they've put into Fort Carson. And this is going to be a worldwide operation where they're going to go in and replace housing all over the world where we have troops. And then these private corporations will collect the rent. The government gives each military person a certain stipend to pay for their rent and whatnot, and that is going to go right into the corporation's pocket. It's actually privatization of military housing.
Yeah, but it sounds like it ties right into with some interviews that I've done recently with your homeowners association, and where they have these entities that are the ones that handle these homeowner associations, and they're becoming big. Untouchable companies that nobody has any oversight over. And it sounds like your thing is carried over into the military, too.
Right. Okay. And Rumsfeld, when he came in, he wanted to make it like a corporation. And basically, that is what has happened, is that a lot of this has been privatized. I mean, we have highways, we have toll roads that we don't even own anymore. There's one in, in Texas, Indiana. These toll roads are given to private companies, I think one from Spain, for a 75-year lease. And they can collect the tolls and raise the tolls and decide who's going to be able to use those roads. And it's all about privatizing the public assets. Now, this also happened with the airways. The airways are public. And they are to benefit the entire, all the citizens in this country. But the airways have been privatized and sold to only about five corporations. And those five corporations basically decide what we are going to hear, what we're not going to hear, and they create our perceptions and our beliefs about things. And yet, the airways used to be public property, and now they're not. And we hear recently about the Fairness Doctrine. I think a lot of the right-wing radio talk show hosts have been saying, oh, gosh, you know, we can't have that Fairness Doctrine. Well, my goodness, you never hear any dissent on any of the major, you never hear any dissent on any privately owned radio station or TV station. The only time you hear anything of a dissenting voice is on the internet, because most of your talk radio is all government friendly. I mean, they position themselves, say, oh my goodness, you know, what's going on in the government, and, you know, there's this orchestrated opposition where they might criticize, but basically 95% of what they say is pro-government.
Well, actually, I was hearing them discuss today that even the left is really getting concerned about that doctrine, too.
Well, we should all be
concerned.
If you want to
call it left.
we should all be concerned. I mean, as far as the left and the right, that's orchestrated opposition, too.
Right,
I mean,
right.
Because both the Republicans and the Democrats are funded by, you have your left, your communist faction, and then you have your right, your fascist faction, and it's orchestrated opposition to battle against each other so that it divides the country. I mean, we've just in this last fiasco, the election fiasco, I mean, you had people who were saying, my gosh, if Obama doesn't win, we're going to riot, we're going to do this, we're going to burn down houses and stuff. I mean, this is terrible.
I was hearing it from
Let's talk about this recent event. You know, I've been listening to public radio, and the pundits are, you know, asking people what they think about this historic election and change involved, et cetera. Could you give us your two cents on what this new administration may bring to the table in terms of some of the policies that you've been concerned about?
Okay, so you have backing him. You have George Soros, okay? You also have Brzezinski. These are not new people. I mean, these people have been around pushing their globalist ideas for a long time. And this is just the regular transition of the guard, the change in the guard. Okay, we've had a fascist dictatorship for the last 8 years. Before that, we had a communist dictatorship. They pretend to be opposed to one another, but all they're doing is carrying forth the agenda that the other side weren't able to facilitate when they were in. And at the end of Clinton's administration, all of the decent people in America, the people who were just absolutely abhorred by his sluttiness. I mean, he was just his womanizing, and that was certainly brought forth at an opportune time, so everybody could get really tired of it, and then look for somebody that was more religious and more conservative, and out pops George Bush, and with his religious agenda that was designed to appeal to the religious right, and so he got in under that fake facade of his, and you know everybody was fooled. Well, not everybody, but a lot of people were fooled. But it was just basically the changing of the guard.
Okay. Well, specifically, you're interested in things like the military expansion. You're interested in things like Agenda 21. You're interested in private property rights. You're interested in loss of private property rights by eminent domain. These are some of the things that you've been writing about in your articles and that have been posted on News with Views. In terms of those issues, how would you perceive that an Obama administration would proceed?
Okay, last year he gave a talk to the Council on Foreign Relations, and he basically said that he was looking at Iran. The policies are not going to change. The policies are not going to change. He said that he would enhance our military. In other words, grow the military. And, you know, all of this takes a lot of money. He's not going to change policies. And his platform was a platform of change. Well, my goodness, now you're looking at more socialism. It's just like when when Roosevelt came in, he really implemented a socialistic society culture. And each administration takes us further and further, closer and closer to having a new world order. And he's not going to be any different. If he were going to be any different, if he were going to be radically different, he would have been neutralized by the media a long time ago, like Ron Paul was. Now, if you're talking change, Ron Paul would have been change, a drastic change. But with Obama, he's talking about health care for everyone. Well, where do you think we're going to get all this money for health care for everyone? And health care was drastically changed after World War II, when you had the insurance companies get in and get their meat hooks into it. And basically, that's a big problem with health care, is that you've got the insurance corporations coming in and wanting to make a killing. It used to be, before the insurance companies got involved, you went to the doctor, you paid the money, and that was it. And it wasn't a lot of money. It was, $5 a visit. As soon as you got health care, the insurance companies in, as soon as you got Big Pharma involved with all of their great big expensive medications, then everything started to be very expensive, so that the average person, unless you have a program with your employer, the average person is just unable to afford medication. And it's basically to enhance the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies.
Going back to Obama, it seems to me that in many ways McCain was scripted to lose this.
Absolutely. He was a
even
loser.
The point where there was a financial meltdown just, weeks before the election.
Yeah.
Seemed like he had everything going against him, and Obama was riding a crest. This was kind of a done deal, or orchestrated perhaps.
Sure.
Yeah,
people weren't voting for Obama. They were voting against the Republicans. And not only did they pick, if they wanted to pick somebody that was comparable to Obama, they would have picked somebody like Mitt Romney, who was at least young enough to have lasted 8 years. I'm not saying McCain is 72 years old. He has, his health is not all that good. Then he had that horrible, military record, which was a horrible military record. When he got home from Vietnam, where he did not suffer like the other POWs did, when he got home, the first thing he did was get rid of his wife, the wife that he was married to. She had been in a terrible accident, an automobile accident. Was not the same person that she was a different person when he got home. And so he hooked up with Cindy, who had got some money from her father. He had a beer distributorship. And, she was flush. And not only was she flush, but she was well-connected to the political climate in Arizona. And so basically he used those that affiliation and those connections to get into Congress. Plus his father was an admiral, and they also covered up the Liberty attack by Israel. So they covered that up, but then they also went in.
Who covered that up?
His father, McCain, and his father. Plus they covered up they concealed the records of at least 2,000 POWs that were still languishing in Vietnam. And that has come out. There's a lot of information about that on the internet, but they certainly weren't going to cover that in the mass media.
And I heard a little bit about, I was just going to say, I heard a little bit about that as far as when, I can't think of his name, that went over there, that was running for president back in the early 90s. I can't think of his name. But anyways,
Perot.
Perot, right.
Yeah. And that was the third party. He got most of his money through government contracts. and they put him up to running.
Oh, really?
So that the election would go to Clinton.
Yes, first of all.
It's my understanding.
That's well, the first I've heard on that, but that is
actually kind of fairly obvious, and this is what happens when you get a strong third party candidate such as Ralph Nader in 2000, who split the vote and swung the election towards Bush.
Right.
I don't think there can be any question about that. Your thoughts on the financial meltdown that we have been experiencing here, Deanna? Do you have any insight ideas about what this is all about?
I think the greatest insight that you can have is to go back and study what happened in 1929. Basically, what has happened in the last 8 years is very similar to what happened before the crash of 29. It's all very orchestrated, and what the Bush administration is doing, they said, you know, that they created a problem, and this is back to, this is your Hegelian dialectics again. You create a problem, and then you offer a suggestion so that you
solution,
can reach
yeah.
a solution that the citizens won't accept, but they're kind of geared so, well, if you don't accept this, then, you know, your mortgage, you're going to lose your homes, and you're going to lose this, and these other things are going to happen. And basically what he was doing was seizing money to feed to his friends at the banks. And some of those funds that were supposed to go to boosting our society's problems, our financial problems, basically went to pay bonuses to the people of the banks. It was just stripping more money out of our economy.
And also they're buying up some of those smaller banks too.
Yes. And we haven't heard this in the news, but a lot of banks have gone under. And this isn't over, okay? This is not over. This is just the calm before the storm. And
well,
we don't know, but Bush has, 72 more days in office. Although he's a lame duck, who knows what he might do. You know, there's going to be the pardons and all the other stuff, some of the same garbage that Clinton did. You know, when he was pardoning Mark Rich and some other really, you know, international criminals. And, you know, who knows what he might take out when he leaves the White House. Furniture, computers, whatever. I mean, we know that Clinton did that. And I don't know, we've been led to believe that Bush is a classier person, but who knows? Who knows what's going to happen?
Well, is just in terms of your gut level feeling, is there a potential, any possibility whatsoever that he might invade Iran?
I think so. There's a possibility, yeah. Yes. Because, you know, what... There might be some sort of false flag operation. I mean, just about every war that we've ever been engaged in has been the result of a false flag operation, including the Mexican-American War. I believe that the Civil War was also a false flag, you know, shooting.
Really? How so?
Well, I mean, there was supposedly Fort Sumter. They fired on federal troops. Well, do we know that for sure? What about the Spanish-American War? Was because there was the battleship Maine that was in Havana Harbor. There was a great big huge explosion, and it turned out to be an internal explosion. But we went into the Philippines. We grabbed the Philippines, seized the Philippines, went in there to civilize those savages. And that was the first time that we engaged in waterboarding. I mean, there are pictures, I believe, in one of my articles where I show pictures of the military using waterboarding on the Filipino natives. And then you had the sinking of the Lusitania. I mean, there's always been some reason to go to war. And then you had Pearl Harbor, which was certainly we knew about the government knew about Pearl Harbor. The Brits had cracked the Japanese code. We were told, and Roosevelt knew about Pearl Harbor. And it was the only way that he could get us into war on the British side. And it changed our financial picture, because we, after World War II, we were very flush, very flush. And
that sounds interesting, to go through a war and come out being flush. I wonder how we pulled that off, because usually that's how they used to, it's often drains a country.
Well, at the time, see, the British owed us a lot of money from World War One, and in order to pay us back, we had to get in and help them win World War Two against the Germans. And also remember that in World War II, more than in any other war, there was a lot of plundering. Okay, lots of plundering. The Japanese plundered 12 countries.
Wow.
12 countries in the Asia, in Southeast Asia. And we're talking billions. Okay? The Germans did the same thing. And all that, a lot of that, most of it, got put in accounts all over the world. Particularly in Switzerland. And so, you know, Switzerland was a neutral country, and it was deemed so back in the, in 1814, Rothschild said, okay, we gotta make Switzerland a neutral country. An eternally neutral country. And so those banks became vaults for plundered goods. And so you have the Germans going in and plundering and plundering and plundering. Well, you have to ask yourself, you know, where'd all that money go? Who's got all that money? I'm doing a bunch of articles about this now.
This is like, it's as though we're playing a Monopoly game.
It is. It is. Or a chess game, per Brzezinski's book, The Grand Chessboard.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to add something to what the discussion here about the impact of World War II on the United States economy. We industrialized on a massive scale, and it was the war industrialization after the Great Depression that brought America into the forefront relative to other countries. And of course, those other first world countries were pretty much smashed after World War II. So,
sure.
And I think
particularly Germany.
Yeah, war, and it was a war economy paid for by the state under FDR, so you had socialized, a social system which put enormous amounts of money into building dams and aircraft and the U.S. infrastructure. So it was the war economy that got us out of World War II, and we have been on a war economy ever since.
Right.
And that is what has kept us from going back into a depression up until now. We're still going into depression now, it seems, but I think, as you said earlier, war is our industrial product. It is our number one industrial activity.
It's the banker's number one product.
Yeah.
We were producing a lot of other things, a lot of other things. And we had a lot of farming. We had a lot of, we were very independent, very independent. But during World War II, with our soldiers fighting elsewhere, in order to attract workers, laborers, companies offered insurance. They said, oh, you know, we'll give you health care, we give you benefits and stuff. And that's how the insurance companies got really big, was right after World War II. So there, you know, just a lot of things, lots and lots of things just have changed our culture, our society, and now all of this is being outsourced to China. I was in China last year, and my gosh, you would not believe the building that is going on over there. Like in Beijing, you could look all over and see these huge, huge cranes building. I mean, it was amazing. Absolutely amazing.
The statistic I've heard is that China is building a city the size of Philadelphia at the rate of once a month.
Yes. Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
All over the country.
And you see it all over the country. All over the country. And it's because they are importing or exporting all of their stuff to us. And we are feeding that money back. And they're loaning us money. And, I mean, it's... We are in very bad shape. And it's, like I say, it's a calm before the storm because it's going to get a lot worse.
And yet we have this incredible military machine, which, as you say, owns something like 64 million acres worldwide, and has a military presence in 130 other countries or whatever it is.
We are the world's military machine.
That's what I figured.
And we really can't afford this military, okay? The bank is funding that. And when it comes time to pay the bank back, well, who do you think is going to be paying the banks back? Because we don't have we are imbalanced. We import more than we export, okay? We are not producing. Any country that is not producing we've become a service-oriented country. We're not producing anything except war.
If I recall from the document of the PNAC document, they were getting into that whole military structure and that. Was that?
Sure.
Yeah.
They wanted dominance. And you know, the PNAC website has been taken down.
Oh, has it? I knew they had been changing it.
It has. Mm-hmm. They took it down. It's no longer available.
Well, let's talk about PNAC a little bit. They more or less gave George Bush his script for his activities as president, including wars of aggression against Afghanistan and Iraq.
Right.
Other countries as well, and it targets other countries as well, up to 60 of them, and it calls for 100 years of American military dominance of the world. It calls for total control of space and cyberspace, full spectrum dominance of the planet,
right,
et cetera, et cetera, and the capability to wage multiple theater wars simultaneously. Now let's look at who are the authors of this think tank, the Project for a New American Century, and we come to find out that they are the neoconservatives, so-called, many, mm-hmm. many of which are Zionist Jews who have dual citizenship, mm-hmm. many of whom have dual citizenship between Israel
and
the United States.
Well, even Chertoff has dual citizenship. What is that all
Chertoff
about?
Chertoff, definitely, yes. Pardon me?
Michael
yes.
Chertoff.
Yeah.
Charge of Homeland Security.
Right. So we have a faction which is very closely allied with the militaristic Likud party of Israel, which has
right.
been writing the script for American foreign policy, including wars of aggression in the Middle East. Now,
right.
I don't know how many people in America are waking up to this fact, but it would appear that not only the oil companies have been dictating American foreign policy, but also the Zionist faction.
Exactly. And the Zionists are funded by, initially by Rothschild. I mean, Rothschild is the one that looked at Israel and you know, there were pogroms in Russia, and there was persecution in other areas just to try to get the Jewish people in other countries to go into Palestine. And that's how you got people down there, is you forced them down there.
Because was that set up because of oil?
There's no real oil in Palestine, but it certainly is a
Or was it to create a base nearby where they knew there was?
It's a focal point, a base, and a they're using it religiously too. Okay.
Well, I would like to go back to this topic of the Zionists because I've just read a book by Michael Collins Piper called The High Priests of War, how
right.
the neoconservative Trotskyites came to power and orchestrated the war in Iraq on their
right.
drive toward global empire. And
right.
It's fairly credible. He just quotes a lot of things right out of newspapers, and he identifies these principal priests of war like like William Crystal and his father, Richard Pearl and Paul Wolfowitz, and it goes right down the list. Charles Krauthammer, many of them very, very powerful in our media.
In the Bush administration, they were all
and in the Bush administration.
So
he makes the point in there that there is a plan to establish a greater Israel, or Eretz Israel, which would extend from the Nile River in Egypt over to the Euphrates in Iraq. And this greater Israel then would be a much, much larger kingdom, and that this is the goal of the Likud Party of Israel, to establish this much larger version of Israel. In fact, even if you look at the flag of Israel, you see the blue stripe at the top and the blue stripe at the bottom and the Star of David in the middle. The blue stripes are supposed to represent the Nile and the Euphrates River, which would then bound this new Eretz Israel, or Greater Israel. And of course, that would help explain why Iran, Iraq, Syria, Jordan, and Egypt, and Saudi Arabia would all be potential targets of U.S. Aggressive wars.
Why would Egypt? It's not between the Euphrates.
Well, half of Egypt is east of the Nile.
Oh, so you're saying Nile and the Euphrates.
The Nile and the
mm-hmm.
Euphrates,
okay.
Yeah.
All right, okay.
But
so
see,
they only want half of Egypt.
See, they've already got the Saudis. You know, they've already got the Saudis. Rockefeller already has agreements there. But they don't have Iran. And, of course, they have Iraq now. But there's a book, it was called Burning Issues. And if you look at the map, starting in 1946 of Palestine, Israel was just a very, very, very small part of that whole land. If you look at a map now, the Palestinians have just a minute piece of the land that they used to have.
Yeah.
And those are people who had been on that land for years and years. And there has always been immigration to the Palestine area of the Jewish people. But they got along with everybody. And in 1947, the UN allocated 56% of Palestine to the Jewish immigrant minority. And they only comprised a third of the population, and they owned 6% of the land. But by 1949, Israel had taken by force another 22%. And in 1967, they occupied the remaining 22%, as well as the Golan Heights, which I was there in, 99. And, I mean, there was problems then. In 99, there was a big military presence there. And I mean, it was a kind of scary to go there.
Wasn't that mm-hmm. though? That wasn't the setting up of that area pretty much under the Zionist direction, and that the Jewish population was pretty much coerced into going there.
Yes, okay. They were coerced by the pogroms. I mean, the original Jewish people who went down there, and they worked their lives out because the land was not habitable, really. Unless you had a camel and a big tent. And so the original Jewish settlers that went down after, you know, in the early 1900s, went there and basically worked to make the land more habitable. But they were forced there. And they were forced to New York and Chicago and Philadelphia and Los Angeles, because when the pogroms were going on in Russia, then the humanitarian efforts were set up by the Rockefellers and other big foundations. So, oh, come over here, we'll help you. And a lot of those people that came over here were then recruited into the Democratic Party.
Hmm.
And it, you know, to boost, you know, to change the voting structure, to change the political landscape. I mean, it's all a big chessboard, okay? And now we have people, for instance, because of the economic situation in Mexico in the 90s, with their peso just plummeting, then you have desperate people coming up from the South, which also changes the political landscape and the cultural landscape and the job situation. See, we have imported cheap labor, and in the meatpacking industry, the chicken industry, the poultry industry, we've imported cheap labor, and basically we have replicated the situation that we had in the early 1900s or late 1800s that you saw written about by what was the name of that book?
Upton Sinclair, The Jungle.
That is the same kinds of working conditions that we have now. We've imported cheap labor because the people like Tyson and some of these other companies, rather than outsource and move out, they're still where they were. They've just got cheap labor, and they treat them just as badly as is noted in the Jungle.
And that's done by design, too, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's all deliberate. It's all devised. It's all deliberate. I mean, if we've got all this military and all this power, certainly we could protect our border, our southern border, but they didn't design it that way. In fact, if you protect it too hard, you're going to get put in jail for it, as were two Border Patrol agents who actually decided that they were going to try to injure somebody that was had a bunch of drugs, and they ended up getting put in jail, and the fellow that they shot, they didn't kill him, but they injured him. He then came back and sued the United States government for damages. So yes, it's and you think that doesn't send a message to the other Border Patrol agents? And then we also have Blackwater. That's another issue, is that we're talking about privatizing of roads and privatization of military bases and whatnot. A lot of our military is now private contractors. About half of the contractors in Iraq right now are private contractors, Blackwater and other groups.
So when you're talking about the military area down by in southeastern Colorado, to maybe tie that into that whole picture right there, do you think possibly that the federal government's trying to acquire as much land as possible?
Oh, absolutely.
In lieu of payment for for resources or whatever to these other countries that we owe so much money?
No. No.
You don't think so? Okay.
They're trying to get rid of the ranchers.
Well, I realize they're doing that, but I thought maybe there's like two or three things being done.
I think there are. I think they're trying to turn it into a wilderness area. I think they're trying to hide, I think probably they're trying to hide nuclear waste there. In fact, there's been opinions proffered that they already have buried nuclear waste, you know, whatever nuclear waste they're not dumping into the Middle East. But they are trying to affect the food-producing economy in that area.
And
the ranchers, and if you put two and two together, and 500,000 ranchers all over the country have left that industry in the last 20 years, this may be the last stronghold for ranching.
It's kind of sad. I was amazed at how many semis I saw with that, you know,
exactly,
trying to
yeah.
advertise their plight.
Yes.
Well, if the plan seems to be simultaneously to take down American self-sufficiency from within and project military power abroad to the point where you might have 100 years, they call it a Pax Americana, as a kind of a reference to the Pax Romana of the Roman Empire,
right.
Or the American peace, kind of cynically, that's what it means. Which of these, something does not ring quite true. You can't have 100 years of American supremacy if America self-sufficiency.
I think that's all that we're producing.
is military protection power.
Yeah, yeah. And see, but that's the same. The military is destroying the economy. The war is destroying the economy here.
Yeah, but they're also destroying the health of these military men as well.
Exactly. Exactly, and not even telling them. And then they come home, and the biggest faction of people who are homeless are ex-military. A lot of ex-military are homeless. They come back, they're traumatized by the experiences that they've had. They don't get the emotional help that they need. And what do they come back to? Not much. You know, they don't come back to jobs. And that, let's see, I was reading something about that the other day. I can't quite call it to mind. In China, in Japan. A lot, when the same thing happened in Japan, when they had the, right before World War II, they had the same kind of a depression that we did here. The 1929 crash caused a depression throughout the world. And they were starving. There was a lot of starvation in Asia and China and in Japan. And so a lot of the people that were very, very hungry, in order to have food to eat, and like in Japan, the people from the rural areas were coming in and joining the military, and these were the same people whose sisters were being sold into prostitution. And it was all a very, very desperate situation. And this might happen in this country where you have the only way that you can earn some money or have a livelihood of some sort is to join the military. And it certainly isn't the elite who are joining the military.
It seems like they're socially engineering us in that direction.
Yes, yes.
Social engineering. Now, there's an interesting word. Deanna, do you have some thoughts about that? What is that?
Well, when you consider that the government is in control of our education, when you consider that the big foundations also established our medical colleges, and when you consider, you know, they've established our education, they run the media, they produce the movies. That's a lot of social engineering. A social engineering designed to, for instance, in China, as soon as the American corporations went into China, they also, Rockefeller went in and established the Union Medical College. Okay, and that was like in 1915. And what he wanted to do was get rid of all that traditional Chinese medicine, you know, the kind that's cheap and it works. Well, he wanted to replace that with pharmaceutical products that a lot of them are byproducts of the oil industry. And, you know, you see a lot of money. You know, when the big corporations look at us as resources, that's a bad situation.
Yeah, when they start calling us human resources.
Yes. See, I mean, the pharmaceutical companies view our bodies as resources or as profit centers.
It is kind of spooky, isn't it?
It is.
Well, you know, going back to the social engineering, I think I have seen documents to the effect that, you know, they know, you know, The Tavistock Institute of Human Relations.
Oh,
and
yes, absolutely.
Various
absolutely.
Equivalents that are in the United States that are, you know, groups with large numbers of PhD psychologists and people who do lots of research in these things, know how to manipulate populations with propaganda and PR.
Oh, absolutely. And they've been doing it for a long time.
And it was big time during this election.
They were big time during this election. I saw a movie recently called The Goebbels Experiment, and it was about, of course, Dr. Joseph Goebbels, who was head of the Ministry of Propaganda in Germany.
Right.
And he said at one point in the movie, a great nation needs great propaganda. And they had great propaganda. They had movies with Ingrid Bergman and things like that, but they called it propaganda. which was, I think, a mistake. in America, we just call it the news, you know, or something like that.
Sure.
You know?
Sure. Well, they got a lot of their ideas from us. They got a lot of their ideas from Bernays.
Right, Edward Bernays, yeah.
Yeah, they got a lot of their ideas. And, in fact, they got their flag salute from us. Our flag salute.
They got their what?
Their flag salute. Their arms straight up in the air.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Okay, that's the way ours looked, too, before we changed it to put your hand on your heart.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I was.
That's another total subject.
I've been observing in this last election, but I also observed it in the prior elections. They were using words or terms that, my understanding is like neurolingual programming. But I was actually, I went in to talk to somebody in a shop here in town, and when I mentioned the word Obama, it was like his eyes glazed over, and. When I realized that term hope and change, it was like they were post-hypnotic suggestion words.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now, could you explain that? I mean, how would we get to that point? How could it be that a word like Obama, a word like hope, a word like change would have some sort of a...
Well, the more you hear phrases, the more you hear a phrase... Well, like, for instance, the very, very traumatic 9/11, when it was just viewed on TV over and over and over and over, and then Osama bin Laden's name was connected to all those views, it traumatized us, and it just absolutely traumatized us. Now, there is online... It's called An Examination of Obama's Use of Hidden Hypnosis Techniques in His Speeches.
Oh, really? That's what I've been looking for.
It is online, and it's 67 pages. I'll send you the link. It's a PDF file.
Okay, great.
And it says that it... Let me read you the first paragraph here. The evidence is here. This document contains over 60 pages of evidence and analysis proving Barack Obama's use of a little-known and highly deceptive and manipulative form of hack hypnosis on millions of unaware Americans, and reveals what only a few psychologists and hypnosis experts know. Barack Obama's speeches contain hypnosis techniques of Dr. Milton Erickson, M.D., who developed a
Milton
form
who?
Of...
Erickson.
Milton Erickson, okay.
Who developed a form of conversational hypnosis that could be hidden in seemingly normal speech and used on patients without their knowledge for therapy purposes. Obama's speeches intentionally contained trance inductions, pre-programmed response adaption, hypnotic anchoring, linking statements and causality bridges, pacing and leading, secondary hidden meanings embedded, suggestions, critical factor bypass, emotional transfer, stacking language patterns, and non-dominant hemisphere programming. Now, that is all foreign to me. But you must admit that the people have been, they either hate him or love him. And those that love him were just, I mean, they would get violent. Aggressive. And there's also that issue about his birth certificate, which we haven't gone into.
What about what?
His birth certificate.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know about that. But this is a very fascinating subject. And of course, what we're hearing on the mainstream media is you know, this is a time of renewed hope. And gosh, you know, I kind of want to feel that too now, you know, after 8 years of Bush.
Sure.
I would like to think that, you know, that the rest of the world is going to look at us in a much more favorable light. We've elected a black man as president, so that would seem to indicate that the American dream is still possible. It's very symbolic.
Absolutely, it is.
Minorities
absolutely.
All over the world are going to just, you know, just relish this, and the American image is going to be, going to make a tremendous comeback overnight.
Well, it depends on how many bombs we drop in Iran.
Yeah, Right, of course. But at least temporarily there is a there is a perception, a widespread perception here and everywhere abroad, that the old America with the positive values of democracy and opportunity for all has made itself heard, and that the people have spoken and everything. But and I want to believe that. But at the same time, what you're saying with this paper by Milton Erickson, M.D., is that Obama has been very cleverly using psychological techniques to essentially to hypnotize people.
Right, and I think
that's not terribly encouraging. What's that?
I think he's been very effective. His speeches, he's well known for his wonderful speeches.
He's a tremendous communicator.
When you listen to people describe him, it's as though they have been, they hear a total different speech than I heard.
Right.
And it's because they're speaking in two different levels of speech that you can interpret in two different ways.
Right. Let me read you another paragraph. Obama's techniques are the height of deception and psychological manipulation, remaining hidden because one must understand the science behind the language patterns in order to spot them. This document examines Obama's speeches word by word, hand gesture by hand gesture, tone, pauses, body language, and proves his use of covert hypnosis intended only for licensed therapists on consenting patients. Obama's mesmerized, cult-like, grade school crush-like worship by millions is not because Obama is the greatest leader of the generation who simply hasn't accomplished anything, who magically inspires by giving speeches. Obama is committing perhaps the biggest fraud and deception in American history.
Well, let's give him his due. The man was a professor of constitutional law, and I would like to have a president who knows something about the Constitution.
I would like to have one that actually follows it.
The man is smart. The man is a great communicator, much better than Reagan, I think, who was called the great communicator, because he's much smarter and thinks on his feet. He is capable of thinking on his feet. We've seen that. He doesn't have to resort to, being prompted. I don't know how Bush did it. Maybe somebody spoke in a microphone in his ear. Maybe he's reading cue cards. Obviously, he couldn't speak on his feet. Obama can. Obama is a smart man. Now, this business of hypnosis, it's an interesting idea. I'd like to see the PDF. I don't particularly right now want to say, oh, yeah, of course, I know that.
But we know who you voted for, Eric.
Yeah, well, of course, I voted for him because, but anyway, I mean, it's possible. I mean, this is a very, very cynical worldview that we're espousing here, and I think we have the responsibility to at least look at all sides of it, and try to prove it. If it's true that Obama is using these hypnotic techniques that would be worthy, say, of the Third Reich, that's bad news, and we need to know about
it.
Okay, one thing I was just going to point out, one thing that keyed me into Obama, it says, look for this sort of thing, and it was when he was first introduced, when he was elected as senator, the very first thing they did was bring him out and say, this is our rising star. And I'd never heard of him. They just introduced him at the convention, and all of a sudden it's like this guy came from out of nowhere, and he was, it was kind of like it was code for saying, he has the blessing of those who, the elites who want him in office.
Well, I mean, the whole Democratic convention was so strange because, first you had the murder of the head of the Democratic delegation, murdered, 2 weeks before it happened.
And who was
then
that?
The Arkansas delegate. His name is Bill Guatney. I think it was Bill Guatney.
I'm not familiar with that.
Okay. He was a super delegate from Arkansas, and he was going to cast his vote for Hillary. And remember, Hillary, basically, they had decided, okay, this was Hillary was running this very tight race, and they were competing against each other, and they both went to the convention, okay, to see, you know, okay, who are they going to pick? And the delegates from California opted not to give their vote. Then the Hillary supporters were all called out to a special meeting. And then they skipped over the California delegates, and they went all the way to New York. And then before they got to New York, Hillary said, you know, I think we just ought to call this off. And Pelosi was the chairman for the convention. And they decided to have a roll call, a verbal roll call, to see who the audience, who the delegates would vote for to be the nominee. Now, keep in mind that the Hillary delegates, the Hillary supporters were gone. And so they called for a voice vote, and everybody said yay for Obama.
And it was a setup.
It was a setup, and it was totally against the Roberts Rules of Order. And so what happened here was that the murder of Bill Guatney, and the person who, the assailant, was immediately shot and killed. And so we don't know why he did it, who set him up, whether he was some sort of Manchurian candidate or whatever. But I'm sure that Bill Guatney's murder sent a message to Hillary.
So this was this year? Is this?
Yes, this was, okay. This was at...
Somehow I missed all of that one.
This was at the Democratic National Convention.
Really?
And
how
it wasn't
did
reported.
Find out about this? What's that?
And this was not reported on the news.
And how did you find out about it?
I read it on the internet.
Okay.
But that's what happened. Because otherwise, I mean, Hillary's delegates, supporters, would have certainly said, well, wait a minute, you can't do this. You know, we came here to cast our vote for Hillary. We're Hillary delegates. You can't do this. But all of a sudden, they got the nomination.
I know they were happy campers because they were really upset.
Right. Yeah. What they did was that they stole the delegates. They snapped they took over the meeting, and he got the nomination. And this is a person, keep in mind that he was a senator from Illinois. He was only in for a short period of time. He's been a do-nothing senator, a junior senator from Illinois. And all of a sudden, he's the president. I mean, he went to Washington and didn't do a darn thing. He went to Washington and immediately started campaigning for president.
Now, you live in the state that he was senator to.
Exactly. I know. Okay. He was a do-nothing senator. Now, he was in Illinois. He was in the Illinois legislature. And he is a resident of the Chicago area. He had ties to some very questionable people. But all of a sudden, he comes from being, you know, the horse at the end in the back, tailing in the back, to being the president. How in heaven's name did that happen?
Can you answer that question? Or at least speculate?
It was orchestrated.
Go ahead.
He was primed to be in the position that he was put into yesterday. And I certainly don't believe that the elections were, I think they were skewed. I think they were orchestrated. I mean, I just, you know, the media was calling the numbers, they were calling the results before California had even closed their polls, for Pete's sake.
Nothing's changed.
Well,
as I recall, and I was watching here in California, the Obama was declared the winner at 8 o'clock, which is just when the polls closed here. So,
how in heaven's...
The polls closed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it was the media who called it. It wasn't our votes that decided it, because I've been an election judge, and it takes time to clean everything up, to get everything in order, to drive it over to the county courthouse. I mean, it takes time to count all these things. Now, when they used to have paper ballots, we wouldn't know for the results for 2 or 3 weeks. And now we know before the minute the polls close. Come on, give me a break. It was the media that decided that he won.
Now, do you suppose, this is all just conjecture, I suppose. It does seem that McCain came out with a very gracious confession speech. I suppose that when they do these election dramas in which the result is known ahead of time, as it may have been for the last three elections,
sure,
at least,
sure,
that the winner knows he's going to win and the loser knows he's going to lose, and
well, sure,
they're planning out a win scenario or a lose scenario. Yeah.
It was very reminiscent of the Kerry concession speech, I would say, and the way he acted.
And they had a great big huge party gathering downtown last night. And
oh, they had 200,000 people there, yeah.
Yeah, that was certainly planned before, and I'm, you know, what if he had lost, would it have been a riot? I don't know. Instead of a celebration.
Okay, so basically your point is that as we seesaw back and forth between Republican administration, which under Bush turned into a fascist dictatorship, over towards a socialist, communist type administration, as we might have under Clinton and Obama, can we expect policy changes? Can we expect the repeal of the Patriot Act? Can we expect the troops to come home from Iraq? Can we expect can we expect improvements in the middle class? Can we expect you don't think so?
No, I mean, how is he going to orchestrate a change in the middle class when so much of our production has left the country? The government does not have the ability to produce anything except red tape and bureaucracy. So how is the middle class going to all of a sudden rise above what has already happened to us in the last 8 years? You can't bring back what has already been outsourced. It's like, you know, you can't bring them back. Trying to collect.
Well, of course, he wants to invest in new programs, you know, in alternative energy and education and healthcare and things that you could conceive as being positive for the economy.
Okay, but those are not constitutional. Those are not government responsibilities. It is not up to the government to be doing those kinds of things. The government, according to the proper role of government and according to the Constitution, they have just two or three things that they're in charge of. One of them is to protect our country in case we're invaded. Another thing is to provide a post office and that sort of thing. But as far as getting into our lives and creating jobs and telling us who to marry and all this other stuff is just simply not constitutional. This is a nanny government. And that was not what the Constitution was set up to provide.
And so, what kind of government?
A nanny government.
Nanny government. Okay. Well, of course, we saw that under FDR, and that helped get us out of the Great Depression. So we may see the same kind of government.
But they created the Depression in order to provide, in order to introduce socialism to begin with.
Right, but we also did the money that was directed towards public projects put a lot of people back to work, and it got a lot of good things done for the country, such as our infrastructure, et cetera. You know,
true,
not all bad.
But is it constitutional?
It's not constitutional.
That becomes an academic question because that's the world we live in. You know, we've had lots of precedent for that kind of government activity, and I'm sure we'll probably see it again.
Well, you know, the whole we started going downhill with the Federal Reserve Act and the establishment of the Federal Reserve when they made all this easy credit available. See, people used to actually save And if they wanted to invest in their business, make more investment in their business, they would do that. And then all this easy credit became very available during the 20s. They also promoted and got people to, the small people, people who were making $650 a month, to invest in the stock market. And with the idea that they would make a bunch of money. And they got a lot of innocent people to do that. And a lot of people lost their land. They lost their homes with the crash. And the money that the common people lost didn't just float out into space somewhere. It went into the bankers' pockets. So it was basically a transfer of wealth from the middle class to the super class, to the elite class. And it's been going on ever since then.
My understanding is once they create the money, it doesn't go away.
Well, it's
right. They transfer it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And
it's
money
system. I like the word super class. I haven't heard super class before, but it sure does apply. It seems appropriate. The 1% of America that owns 90% of the assets. We've never been
exactly.
in such a situation of inequality in this country in our history. And
right.
that, you'd have to call them the super class, yeah.
Right. And now you have a lot of people who are looking to the government instead of themselves to take care of their needs. And that's just not what the government was designed to do. We are supposed to be independent. We're supposed to take care of ourselves. God has given us the ability to make decisions and to be free agents. And we basically have given up our much of our responsibility to take care of ourselves to the government. And whatever the government controls or whatever they take care of, they control. And so we're nothing but a bunch of slaves to the Federal Reserve.
But again, that's by design, so that, because I mean,
it is.
We're independent, and now we're being guided into being
right.
dependent. Yes.
I mean, look at the credit. I mean, 20 years ago, when credit cards, 30 years ago, when credit cards were made available, people didn't used to use the credit like they do now. Now everything's on credit. You also have two people in the household working, and basically that just adds income tax adds money to the Federal Reserve, because now not only is just the guy paying income tax, but they're paying income tax on the woman's salary too, and the Rockefeller Foundation basically is the entity that promoted equal rights. And they funded Gloria Steinem. They funded her magazine. And basically, they were promoting something that was a fallacy in order to split the gender, get a gender war going. But basically, that gender war created more money for the Federal Reserve, because women thought, oh, I've got to go out and really contribute to society, and why would I want to stay home and have children and be a mother. And people were fooled into thinking that they were being more than just a housewife.
Are you familiar with the Rees-Dodd Commission?
Yes, I am.
Okay. What was your interpretation of what took place there?
Well, basically, that was the foundation. Dodd was the investigator for the Rees Foundation. And that was like in 1953. And they went back into the documents that were created right after the Federal Reserve was created to figure out, okay, what are these people doing? And the secretary, the little investigator, she was a lawyer, and he sent her in to start going through some of these documents. And it absolutely blew her mind, because she had no idea that people could be so corrupt and so evil as to want to take all of this control and power and the resources of other people. And also they said, okay, we are going to have war. and they actually planned World War One. Is that the concept that you got?
Right, but I also understood that they were finding that it was a non-governmental organizations that were...
Oh, absolutely.
Well, foundation. It was a congressional investigation.
Tax-exempt foundations, I'm sorry.
Right.
Yeah, non-governmental organizations are kind of modern equivalents thereof, or a special kind, but foundations are the original thing, yeah.
Right, and there was a book written, I don't have it in my upstairs. I have a great big bookcase upstairs, and I have a great big bookcase downstairs. It must be in the downstairs one.
you've read a lot of books.
Well, you know, while we do have a pause here, and we're talking about your books and your background, I'd like to just ask you to tell us about your website and where you post your articles a little bit, so people who are listening want to follow up, they can go to those places.
Sure. I have my own website. It's Spingola.com, www.spingola.com. And I have all my articles there. And I also write for six other websites, News with Views, Renew America, The People's Voice, Navakio. Let's see, what other ones? Raider News.
Do those all come up when you type in your name?
Yes. And let's see, Terry Mangelson's site, the Conspiracy Archive, which has a lot to do with the Illuminati. And then my articles are picked up by other sites, blogs and whatnot.
Now, let me just ask you this. When you write an article, could you give us an idea of the process that you use? What's your strategy? Is there a special kind of approach you have to getting your articles published on particular sites, et cetera? How does all that work? Let's say somebody else wants to write an article and get it posted. How would they go about that?
I'll tell you my experience. When I first started writing for News with Views, and that was the first site that I started writing for, I had been reading them for a couple of years, and I thought, well, gosh, I wonder if I had to write an article, because I've always loved to write. My grandfather, who was an aide to General Butler, was
really?
A writer.
That's interesting.
Yes, he was a writer. He was the Pulp King of America. And so I feel like I've inherited some of those writing genes. And so I decided I would write an article, and I sent it in to them, and they published it. I wasn't regular at that point in time. It was just I just contributed an article. And so I thought, well, okay, I'm going to write another one. And with the second article that I wrote, the editor called me up and he said, we'd like to have you be a regular contributor. And we need to have a photo and, a little bio of you. And so I did that and sent that in. And I've just been writing ever since. And then, I became aware of other sites and, started contributing to other sites. And,
so is there
started. Is there a method to my madness about how I create an article?
Well, no, I was going to ask you, is there any kind of a peer review process? Is there any kind of editorial oversight, or do they bounce back some of your articles with other ideas? They accept them as you write them? Do they pay you, et cetera?
No, I don't get paid. I do this because I'm obsessive compulsive, and I feel like it's my contribution to the liberties of our country.
I think there's a lot of us doing that.
Yes, I think we all do a lot of free stuff because it matters.
Mm-hmm.
It matters to us. Our country matters to us. We hate to see what's going on. We want to try and stop the progress of the New World Order. We hate the corruption. We hate seeing what our country is doing in other countries, the slaughter that's going on. The mass murder, the all the stuff that's going on is just outrageous. And so that's what we all do. We all do what we can. We use our skills and we do what we can to try to prevent it, to try to halt it, to try to do anything that we can to stop it.
And you know, by all means, I think we're all grateful for the work you're doing and many others like you. Now, in this process, and I consider that the height of patriotism also. But
well, you do
process,
it too.
Well, I do it too. Yeah, and of course,
right.
I do it on my spare time, just like you do.
Sure.
But to what extent have you gotten connected with others, other groups, and other individuals? Through this process?
Well, I'm active in the anti-war. You know, if there's a parade going on, I'm active in that. I marched in a great big anti-war demonstration in Chicago. I meet other people. I get a lot of email, so I meet a lot of people. I run a 9/11 list. It's called Total 9/11 Truth Now, that I started. I was a member of the scholars group, the 9/11 scholars,
mm-hmm.
and then it split in December of 06, and so I thought, oh, I'm just going to, just to keep in touch. I don't want to lose touch, and I want to keep in touch, so I created this email list, and it's growing, and we, you know, it's a community. It's an online community so that we know that we're not alone. That it's not.
Can you put me on that list?
Sure, I'll send you an invitation.
Please do.
And
I've been working on 9/11 ever since 9/11, and that's what has turned me into a very, very kind of dedicated citizen activist as well. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a watershed moment. 9/11 was a watershed moment. It woke a lot of people up, and it put a lot of people. It made a lot of other people very vulnerable, so they believed whatever the government said. And when they said, oh, we're going to go into Iraq, nobody said a word. When they said, we're going to go into Afghanistan, nobody said a word, because we were all so many people were traumatized by what they saw on 9/11 that they were willing to give up their liberties for promised security. And a travesty, a terrible thing.
Well, this
false
is what
flag operation.
This is what, yeah, it's a psychological operation. It's called mind-based trauma-based
right.
mind control.
Right.
And it has been extremely effective for many who still can't even revisit the whole event mentally. And as I don't know, are you familiar with Dr. Judy Wood and her site?
I am.
Yeah. She I've heard her giving some interviews recently, and I happen to think she's right that the directed energy weapons were used and no planes were used, and this was a very, very masterful psychological operation. She said the extent of the psychological operation can be seen by the fact that it took 5 years for one person to ask, where did the buildings go?
Exactly.
5 years. And of course, she has pretty much figured out where the buildings went, but so many other people can't even look at the issues surrounding that. They just, immediately have a knee-jerk reaction that you're a loony or you're bad or something.
Absolutely.
To bring it up. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. And they think, you know, people generally are good. They have no concept, absolutely no concept, that there would be a group of evil people who would kill innocent people for their own agenda. And because they would never dream of doing anything like that, they find it very difficult to believe that their government would do that to them. Even though they know that the government lies, cheats, takes their money, they know that politicians are disreputable, they lie during the campaigns, and yet they cannot believe that the government would do that. And yet they did it at Pearl Harbor. And this was PNAC's new Pearl Harbor.
Right.
And I think David Ray Griffin's book was a masterpiece, and it did wake up a lot of people, but not enough. And, you know, even though there is a 9/11 truth movement, I personally believe that it is a very controlled movement. That you know, if you control both sides, like with the anti-war movement back in the Vietnam days, if you control both sides, so you can you can control the results. And I believe there is some amount of control in the 9/11 movement.
Oh, I believe there's a high amount of control. I've never been part of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, but Melody and I have interviewed a number of so-called experts on 9/11, and there does seem to be a high level of control. And on Dr. Judy Wood's site, she quotes Lenin right at the very front, saying, "The way to control, in order to control the opposition, the best way is to lead it ourselves."
Exactly.
And that's from Lenin, you know. And so what we are dealing with is a bunch of these neocons are ex-Trotskyites. They're coming from a communist pedigree, many of them, ideologically. And, of course, we know how ruthless the communists were in Russia and China. And that
it's
same
amazing.
Ruthlessness, yeah.
It's amazing that they found their way into the Republican Party.
Yes.
You know, with the neocon.
To control it as much as they have. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, you know, they're going to if they've been in control in the Republican, then they're going to have to be in the Democratic one as well. Yeah.
Sure.
Well,
you know,
of course, George Soros is heavily involved with the MoveOn.org campaign.
Oh, absolutely. He funded this whole thing.
Yeah, he funded it, and he's one of the principal underwriters of the entire Obama candidacy. And you know, the Obama candidacy spent much more than any previous candidacy, and was very, very well organized. So, yeah, the Democrats
and they collected a lot.
Yeah.
$690 million. Where'd that come from?
I heard there was $2 billion spent on that.
Wow.
So the Democrats are you know, also very, very controlled, and probably ultimately by the same people, but with a slightly different methodology and focus.
Sure.
Yeah.
Opposition.
Right. And I would say, just, you know, whereas the Republicans gave us the phony war on terrorism in order to scare us into submission, the Democrats are giving us the phony fear of global warming, and I do teach climatology, and I do believe that this is a contrived scare, and doesn't fit with the actual science of climatology very well.
It's cyclical. I think global warming is cyclical. It depends
There's many natural causes of climate change,
and
it is so extraordinarily complex that you can't get a group of scientists to agree on the causes of climate change, or indeed the role of you know, humans adding CO2 to the atmosphere relative to these other factors. So could you mention HAARP? Because now we perhaps, you know, I listened to Obama or some radio announcer saying that, okay, Obama's got some big ticket policies to address now that he's, you know, going to be coming to office, and one of them is energy policy, and one of them is climate control. Okay, so climate control is one of his main policies. Well, what does that mean?
That means you get the global warming and the freezing all in one.
What does that mean? Does that mean they give us more HAARP, that they steer more hurricanes, that they create cold fronts, that they dump chemtrails into the upper atmosphere to warm it?
Sure.
What does that mean, climate control?
Or do they put more snow into southeast Colorado like they did in December of 2006? I mean, that was a record snowfall there.
It's impossible to prove that they did it, because weather is a natural phenomenon, and so you have the ultimate deniability.
But if they say they control the weather, how can they deny that they're involved?
Well, they don't say it on national TV.
They said it in some documents that they did.
But you know, that isn't on national TV.
Right. There are Air Force documents saying one called Owning the Weather by 2020. And that's U.S. Air Force. And many think that they kind of own the weather already, but it's very hard to prove. Now, Judy Wood believes that Hurricane Erin was a huge Category 3 hurricane, which was right off the coast from Manhattan on the morning of September 11th, and that this may have been the energy source for this directed energy weapon, and yet the local news did not even show a hurricane there, and yet it was studied by many universities.
Boy, I'd love to see the science.
It was the size of Hurricane Katrina, and it was off the East Coast. And she's got a whole web page on this with lots and lots of photos, and tracking it from September 1st to up till September 11th when it was just off the coast of Manhattan, and then it went off to the North Atlantic and dissipated. So she thinks that was controlled. A very fascinating subject. I don't know how we can know unless we get some reliable accounts. But Judy Wood certainly seems to be pretty reliable in her investigation.
She has a lot of critics too, which is unfortunate. And I think that's that orchestrated opposition again, because they don't want any talk about directed energy. You know, there's that faction that says no, it was controlled demolition, and they don't even want to talk about directed energy. But yet they cannot explain all those burned out cars and all the other evidence.
Or the molecular dissociation, which caused the buildings to come down at the speed of gravity, and it caused the buildings not to leave a rubble pile over one story high.
Dust. Exactly.
Just to turn the whole thing into dust, as she calls it, dustification.
Right.
But the amazing thing about Judy Wood's site, and I do find it compelling, is that she's saying what happened on 911 is we saw a demonstration of free energy. The kind of thing that Nikola Tesla was talking about 100 years ago.
Exactly.
And that this energy could be used for good. And that this energy, if this technology were widespread, this would mean the end of poverty. That we could have an entirely different world based on these kinds of technologies.
Does she think it has to do with any of the Tesla, Siberian?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, I don't know about the Siberian thing, but Tesla talked about a death ray. And he talked about having the technology to split the Earth in half. And, of course, well, this would be extremely low-frequency waves that are propagated. And Tesla knew how to do that, and apparently now the U.S. military also knows how to do this.
Because they got all of his records.
What's that?
They did?
They confiscated his records at his death. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
he was poverty stricken. Yes. They got them all.
Yeah. So this appears to be, we're in the age now finally of Nikola Tesla's, well, we've been in the age of Nikola Tesla's inventions for the last 100 years with radio
and
x-rays. And he knew a lot about how electromagnetic waves work. But he was 100 years or more than 100 years ahead of everybody. And now it appears that the military has perfected this technology.
Right.
Now the role of HARP is somewhat unknown, but it may be a factor, and that of course is a installation in Alaska that the military, the Air Force has built and constructed.
Right.
Do you have any insight into HARP?
Well, I've read Begich's book, and I also have one of his films, but just other than what I've read that he said.
Yeah. Altitude active auroral frequency program.
Right.
But anyway, I'm glad to hear that you have this email list, and I'd be happy to be on it.
I will send you an invitation.
Please, because it has been fascinating to watch the whole thing and watch the level of disinformation and kind of orchestrated disputes and. To the point where many people are saying, you know, it's more important to preserve the truth movement than it is to preserve the truth, you know.
Oh, I know.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and it's amazing that as many people as are involved in it, that, and it could go on forever, that we don't really know. And I think that it was designed that way so that there's so many, how don't know how to say it. There's so many questions that are unanswered.
And I think we keep coming up with more and more.
That you keep coming up with things, and so it creates an environment of divisiveness. Because there are people.
Well, you know, I guess I don't completely agree with that. Having looked at these issues myself extensively, I think Judy Wood is right. Directed energy weapons were used. I think Morgan Reynolds is right. There were no plane impacts on the buildings, and indeed at any of the sites.
But wait till you say that on my list.
Well, see, that's the thing. There are many operatives. You know, as Barbara Honegger said, the third responsibility of the perps is to control the opposition. And
exactly.
So what you see in the 911 truth movement is perhaps, I don't know what the ratio is, but it could be as many as one agent per genuinely concerned independent citizen. These agents have time and money at their disposal, and they can spend a lot of time creating a lot of disinformation and a lot of problems.
And that's all they do all day.
Yeah.
You know, that's their job. That's their full-time job.
Right. Right.
To provoke.
So then the challenge becomes to try to find separate the wheat from the chaff. In other words, the genuine truth seekers from the disinformation artists. And I suppose after, 7 years, don't you feel like you've gotten to the point where you feel comfortable doing that, or you have a sense now of who?
Sure. Yeah.
I certainly do. Yeah.
But there's a lot of disinformation, misinformation, and there's some people who are genuinely serious about what they believe, and they're not trying to promote disinformation.
Right, right.
But they simply believe a certain thing.
I'll give myself as an example. In 2006, for the fifth year of 911, I thought I would put together a scenario for what happened based on all the best information I could find. So I downloaded all these articles, and I wrote about an 80-page paper in which I suggested that it collapsed from controlled demolition with thermite, and that 737 military 737s were used and not passenger planes. In other words, I made lots of mistakes that I know now are mistakes, but that at the time I thought they were the best explanation.
Sure.
And so I think it's possible for sincere people to pass on false impressions and disinformation.
Not trying to do that, and not intentional, that's just how they believe, and that's what, it's all a process of learning, that we learn something, and then we learn something else that we don't believe what we originally learned, or what we originally believed.
That's getting discernment of being able to judge, to assess the person as well as the information.
Sure. And sometimes that's really hard to do. That's very hard to do, because people can be very sincere and, have a black heart. Difficult.
I guess we kind of need to come to an end here, and I just wondered if there was anything that either one of you wanted to put into a summation of what we've covered here, or anything? Anyone?
Well, I would just like to thank Deanna again for talking to us and for the work she's doing. I find it very, very heartening and refreshing that someone is as widely read and knowledgeable as she is about so many important things, and it makes for a very stimulating conversation and interview. So thanks. It's been a lot of fun to talk to you again, Deanna.
Oh, well, thank you for asking me. It's been wonderful, and thank you for your kind comments.
And I say thank you, too, and thank you for your willingness to come back and try it again.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you. Thank you very much.
For my bonehead technology.
I've enjoyed it.
Well, keep up the good work. Keep up the good fight, and we'll just hope for the best. And like the Russian, to pray to God, but keep rowing to shore.
Yeah,
that's right.
The Russian proverb,
Yes.
And again, thanks, Eric, for coming on.
Good to talk to you. Okay.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Bye. Bye. Bye.